He was laying it on pretty thick and said something about the artist painting this piece with a special paintbrush. I was waiting for him to say the paintbrush was made with a single hair from the tail of a unicorn. I get it. It's a really nice painting, which at least explains why it cost more than my first four cars. Still, I wanted the painting more than I wanted food, so I started saving. It took about a year to save the money. For the final bit, I was ready to put our family dog on eBay, but after a family meeting, that idea was shut down. No matter. I finally called the guy at the gallery and told him I'd be coming by to pick up the painting that afternoon. When I walked into the gallery, there were two paintings waiting for me. Two exact paintings of the puppeteer. I didn't understand. Why are there two paintings? I asked the guy with a muddled accent. Well, he said, managing with absolute ease to sound condescending and slick, the one on the left is the real one. It's museum qualité. It's very expensive, almost priceless. You don't want to hang the original where it might get damaged, so you put the original in a vault. This other one, however, he said as he slapped the identical painting irreverently, is the fake, and you put that one on the wall for everyone to see. I get a fake one along with the original? I asked. I'd never heard of such a thing. Yes, he shot back. Well, let me ask you, dear reader, which of the two paintings would you put up on the wall? Me too. I hung the real one and threw the fake one in a closet somewhere. I get why the guy at the gallery wanted me to hang the fake one and hide the real one to keep it safe. If the original were put out and was damaged, it would be a huge loss. This was original art from a master artist who was not long for this earth. It was rare, one of a kind, and irreplaceable. If you come over to the Goff House, come armed. We have incredible rubber band wars. Not the paper route, elementary school kind of rubber band wars. We go nuclear, and no one is safe. When the kids stretch a rubber band a foot or so, it can raise a welt the size of a strawberry wherever you get hit. I start every morning sitting in a certain chair at my house. It's opposite from where I hung the original puppeteer painting. I love starting every day with a cup of coffee, a small fire, and seeing my friend, the puppeteer, delighting his family. Through the divided light windows, I watch the sun come up over the water with colors sometimes too beautiful to be real. Two windows perfectly frame the puppeteer painting that invites onlookers to see what appears to be his next show, which has just started. When I look at the puppeteer, it reminds me of what the future looks like for me. It reminds me of what's valuable in life. It reminds me of the stories, like the kind Jesus told. And I think about how much I love that it's the original hanging on the wall, not the fake one. I woke up one morning a while ago, poured my coffee, lit a small fire, and took in the beauty of the pre-dawn colors draping over the bay as I took my usual morning spot. As I lifted my eyes toward the puppeteer, ready to wish a good morning to my friend, my jaw dropped. The night before, as best I could tell, the puppeteer had taken a rubber band right in the face. I'm not kidding. There was a mark right in the middle of his almost priceless forehead. I gasped and spilled coffee on myself as I sprung to my chair to get a closer look. Indeed, the puppeteer had taken a headshot. To his credit, the puppeteer didn't drop the puppet, even though mortally wounded. Now, my kids say they didn't do it, and I think it was my rubber band that took him out. But I've sent the painting off to the FBI crime lab. It was the kids. At least that's my story. It's been a while since the puppeteer took a hit, but I still enjoy my morning routine. I still sit in my favorite chair every morning, have a coffee, light my fire, watch the sunrise, and look at my favorite piece of art, the original puppeteer painting. I'm still taken by its beauty. But do you think I see damage when I look at the puppeteer each morning? Not at all. I'm not mad or disappointed in the least. The reason is simple. The rubber band marks remind me exactly and fondly of my kids. I see my kids and the engaged life we've spent together so far. I see all the mischief, the whimsy, the spontaneous combustion that is their hallmark. I see the kids laying in wait for me. Rubber bands pulled tight at the top of the stairs and around the corners when I come home after work at night. Truth be known, I like the original puppeteer painting now more with the rubber band mark on it. There have been times in my life when I've tried to do good and it hasn't worked out the way I thought it would. I've gotten into a lot of mischief and taken chances and even taken some big risks. In the process, sometimes I've let people down or things didn't go well, and I've taken a rubber band or two in the head. We all have. But after the puppeteer painting got shot, I realized that God doesn't think any less of us when things don't go right. Actually, I think he plans on it. What he doesn't plan on is us putting a fake version of ourselves out there to take the hit. God is the master artist and made an original version of us, a priceless one that cost everything to create, a version that can't and won't be created again. He asks us to hang that version of ourselves for everyone to see. Despite our inherent beauty, each of us is tempted to hide the original so we won't get damaged. I understand why. I really do. In the fake version of us, it's not worthless, it's just worth less, because it's only a copy of the real us, a version we don't care about that much. When we hang the fake version out there, it's not the version God created. In that sense, it's like an imposter, a poser, a stunt double is standing in for us and is telling the world that this is the best we've got or the best we'll risk. And when we put the cheap, fake version of ourselves out there, most of the time, it probably comes off to God like a bad Elvis impersonation. The Bible says people who are friends of God are new creations. The way I heard it's supposed to work is that the old version of us goes away and a new original is painted. I can understand that picture better now because I've purchased an expensive painting, and I've also had a cheap copy thrown in so I could hide the original one. What I know now is that our infinite value, the original masterwork that we are, is placed in us because God is the master artist, not us. The best we could muster ourselves would be a fake. God invites us to be new creations, original art, and to live into a life of engagement. He says to leave the cheap imitation in a closet somewhere. He doesn't say when we hang the original out there, the priceless one, that things will go great either. It's pretty clear from watching Jesus' followers, past and present, that when you risk the real you, you'll probably take a hit. God did when he hung Jesus out there. But one thing I do know is this. When we do take hits, and we will, God isn't going to think less of us. Instead, he gets up early, he lights a fire, sits in his favorite chair, and gazes at the original masterpiece he made in us. And you know what? He loves us even more. Rubber band marks and all. Chapter 23. Friends, welcome home. I used to think following God required a lot of navigation, but now I know all I need is a line and a circle. Ever since high school, I wanted to go on a really long sailing trip. In fact, a buddy and I decided one day we'd sail across the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii. Since 1906, every other year, there's been a race from Los Angeles to Hawaii. It's called the Transpac Race. For safety reasons, the rules require that competing boats be 45 feet or longer with a full crew. But on this particular year, they changed the rules to allow smaller boats to go. We signed up to enter the race with a 35-foot sailboat. Now, 35 feet doesn't sound that small at first, until you figure out that it's about twice the length of a Toyota Camry, and a little narrower. After you subtract the pointy end, it's about the size of a 1960s VW bus, filled with 25 huge bags of sails, a life draft, 6 cases of Stag Chili, 600 bottles of water, 5 guys and a porta potty. Come to think of it, that's what a lot of 1960s VW buses still look like inside. The plan was simple. We'd sail 2,600 miles across the ocean in our VW bus at 7 miles an hour, while God threw 3 garbage cans full of ice-cold water in the windows every couple minutes. And while all this happened, we'd just eat chili and tell manly stories about ourselves. There were supposed to be 6 guys on the trip. None of us knew how to navigate, and we didn't want to miss Honolulu, so we asked a friend who was a navigator on a U.S. Navy destroyer to come with us. He said yes, so we had our ringer. We were styling. Navigating the race is no small task. You can't just use a GPS to figure out where you are. Instead, there's a requirement that each of the boats steer by the stars and the sun. To do this, our navigator had a couple feet of books, mostly almanacs, estimating where the sun and planets would be at any particular time. From these, and with the help of a sextant, which locates where you are in relationship to the sun and stars, you could do some complicated math and figure out exactly where you were. Unfortunately, a few days before the race, The Navy changed our navigator's orders. He couldn't come. We were no longer styling. The race was going to start soon, so the next day we drew straws to see who would replace the navigator. I've hated straws ever since. With our Navy navigator leaving, he took all of his gear with him too, the stack of books, the knowledge, and even his fancy sextant. He let me hold the sextant once, and I remember pointing it toward the sky like Galileo, but I didn't have any clue how to use it. We were really in trouble, so I ran to the local marine supply store and for $15 bought a plastic sextant and got 20 minutes of instruction from the guy in aisle 3 on how to use it. How tough could it be, after all? He said there's a complicated way to use a sextant properly. It involves looking to the heavens and finding a few fixed points. Then you look up what you found in a couple feet of books and do lots of math. If you do all the calculations right, you can figure out pretty close to where you are, which is amazing, actually. Then there are 100 nuances to be factored in from there to figure out precisely where you are. What time of year it is, what ocean and hemisphere you're in, the wave height at the time you're taking the sighting, how far above the surface of the water you're standing, what you had for lunch, and your favorite color, I suppose. My head was going foggy as the guy in aisle 3 ran through a list of things I would need to consider to make an accurate computation of our exact location. I wondered what this guy was doing selling boat parts, anchors, and bottom paint. He was talking like a guy who had a doctorate in astrophysics. After 20 minutes, I interrupted Copernicus and explained that we were leaving for Hawaii in 3 days, and I didn't follow much of what he just said about how to calculate my location. Isn't there a faster way to use the sextant to get a trustworthy guesstimate, I asked, like Columbus or the Vikings or Kon-Tiki did? I'm sure they didn't get wrapped around the axle with all of the details or have 2 feet of books to look at to figure out where they were. Did they even have books then? The guy in aisle 3 leaned forward and hushed his voice as if he were inviting me into the witness protection program. Okay, here's what you do. He said I should take the plastic sextant up on the deck, point it toward the sky, and take a reading at 5 minutes to noon, at noon, and at 5 minutes after noon. By doing this, I'd have a couple fixed points from the sun, and from there I could figure out where we were within a circle of give or take 60 miles. Water covers about 140 million square miles of the entire surface of the Earth. So I figured if I could find myself within a 60-mile circle somewhere along a line pointing towards Hawaii, that sounded close enough. My overall plan was to head west until we made landfall. It seemed simple and straightforward enough. There are lots of Hawaiian islands, so I figured, honestly, if we got to any of them, instead of making our first landfall in Japan, it would be a win. The other thing I got at the Marine store before I left for Hawaii was a map. It was as big as a table, but it didn't really have much information on it. It just had a huge empty space between the West Coast on one side and Hawaii on the other. I'm no oceanographer, but I figured that everything in between was water. There was a compass rose printed in the upper corner. It had a big N at the top, so I deduced it was telling me which way was north. Good to know. Of course, when all you have is water around you, there are no landmarks to help orient your direction. I'm not sure how much an N would help us get to Hawaii. No matter, I guess. I got a yardstick and I put one end on the starting line in Los Angeles and the other end I put on Diamond Head in Oahu. Then I drew a straight line. That was easy enough. From the compass rose, I figured out what heading to steer, and with that, I took my map, my ruler, my plastic sextant, and headed for the boat. There's a navigation technique that helped me on the transpac race, and it's also pointed me generally in the right direction in life. The concept in sailing is known as dead reckoning. The idea is a simple one, so it's right in my wheelhouse. It involves using your compass to take a bearing off a couple fixed points and then drawing a line from each one to you in order to determine where you are. When I don't know the answer to where I am or what God wants me to be doing, which is often, I try to get a bearing on at least a couple fixed points that I can trust. One is Jesus. I know that sounds like a canned Sunday school answer, and I tend not to like those, but it's true. I take a bearing off what I know about Jesus. But it's a Jesus that isn't encumbered by religion, denomination, and cultural overlays. I look at what he had to say about where I am, and then I draw a line from Jesus to me. The other fixed point I use is a group of people I feel God has dropped into my life, kind of like a cabinet. These people have their particular areas of wisdom and experience, and I use them to bounce ideas off of and get their input. In turn, I'm on the cabinets of many of my friends and family members too. For instance, I'm on my daughter Lindsay's cabinet. I've appointed myself to be in charge of homeland security for her. The people on my cabinet help me to do some dead reckoning in my life, because I take a bearing on their counsel as another fixed point in my life, and I draw a line from them to me. From these points, dead reckoning is actually pretty easy. Where all of these lines cross is where God probably wants me to be. I think that navigating a relationship with a living God can be just that easy, and the math is easy too. It's just Jesus plus nothing. I used to think following God required complicated formulas. I thought I needed a big stack of books so I could figure out exactly where I was all the time. I thought if I constantly measured the distance between God and me, I'd get closer to Him. Early on, the religious people I knew explained to me all kinds of nuances for doing this sort of spiritual math. They suggested that I say certain things in my prayers, have quiet times, go to Bible studies, and memorize Bible verses. They said I needed to know how to explain to someone that God could be a person and a spirit at the same time. They urged me to know how God was going to come back someday, but that some people would be here and other people would go missing because it would be a time of great tribulation. They said that for me to know God, there was a whole pile of things I'd need to know first. Honestly, they sounded a lot like the guy in aisle 3. What I realized, though, is that all I really needed to know when it came down to it was the direction I was pointing and that I was somewhere inside the large circle of God's love and forgiveness. I've made refinements and countless mid-course corrections in my life. There have been more than a couple times when I've navigated potentially disastrous issues and needed more exact and specific direction. And when I did, I had the resources I needed to figure it out. But most of the time, even though the guy in aisle 3 and some religious people would squirm, just pointing in the right general direction has been good enough. I think that's probably because I see myself floating in a massive sea of God's love. The circle of His grace and forgiveness is big enough, and the line leading to Him is long enough that I don't always need to be measuring latitude and longitude to find myself. It's a pretty easy calculation each day, actually. I'll tell you how I do it. I find Jesus, keep pointing towards Him, and stay somewhere in that circle. That's it. You can keep your sextant and almanacs. There's a tradition in the Transpac race, no matter when you finish the race, even if it's 2 a.m, when you pull into the Ilokai Marina in Oahu, there's a guy who announces the name of the boat and every crew member who made the trip. There's a huge loudspeaker, and his booming voice bursts through the trade winds and welcomes each person home. It's the same guy, and he's been announcing each boat's arrival at the end of every Transpac race for decades. I'll spare you most of the details of the trip. Just know it involved a lot of water, some stinky dudes, overblown stories of manhood, and lots of canned meats and chili. Just when we came to the end of our supplies, we sailed across the finish line just off Diamond Head and into the marina. It was a few hours before dawn. It had been 16 days since we set out from Los Angeles in our little boat, knowing very little about navigation. Suddenly, the silence was broken by a booming voice over a loudspeaker, announcing the name of our tiny boat. Somehow, the way he said it, we sounded like we were the size of an aircraft carrier. Then he started announcing the names of our ragtag crew, like he was introducing heads of state. One by one, he announced all of our names with obvious pride in his voice, and it became a really emotional moment for each of us on board. When he came to my name, he didn't talk about how few navigation skills I had or the zigzag course I'd led us on to get us there. He didn't tell everyone I didn't even know which way north was or about all my other mess-ups. Instead, he just welcomed me in from an adventure like a proud father would. When he was done, there was a pause. And then in a sincere voice, his last words to the entire crew were these, "Friends, it's been a long trip. Welcome home." Because of the way he said it, we all welled up and fought back tears. I wiped my eyes as I reflected in that moment about all of the uncertainty that had come with the journey, all of the sloppy sailing, and how little I knew. But none of that mattered now because we had completed the race. I've always kind of thought that heaven might be kind of a similar experience. I read somewhere in the Bible that there is a book of life. I don't think that this book of life is full of equations, and I don't think it's just a list of names either. I think that this book of life is more like a book of lives, a book of stories. I bet it's about people traveling in the direction of Jesus, trying to follow him. People like me, who made lots of mistakes in mid-course corrections. It's of people who stayed within the large circle of his love and grace, staying the course on a long line pointing towards him. And their names weren't in the book because of what they did or didn't do. They were in there because of who God is and what he had done to draw a circle around them. After we each cross the finish line, I imagine it like floating into the Hawaiian marina when our names were announced, one by one. And at the end, perhaps simple words spoken by a loving and proud God will be, "Friends, it's been a long trip. Welcome home." Chapter 24. Lose the Cape. I used to think I should talk about everything, but now I know it's better to keep some things a secret. Do you know the movie The Incredibles? There's a superhero dad in the movie, and he's tired of his desk job. He sells insurance, I think, but he knows that's not the real him. So he starts doodling on his sketch pad, drawing different superhero suits because he wants to go back to being who he knows he really was meant to be. Most of the outfits he draws have capes, because that's how most superheroes dress, and he wants to be the same as them. He has a friend, Edna, who makes superhero uniforms, and every time he shows her a design, she keeps telling him to lose the cape. She shows him movie clips of superheroes who wore capes, and in the end, the capes cause big problems for them, like getting caught on something and causing them to be sucked through a jet engine or worse. That's her reason for my favorite line in the movie, "No capes." Her point, I think, is that you can get a lot more stuff done without a cape. I think Jesus agrees. It seems like every time Jesus did an incredible thing, he would say something similar to the people nearby. He raised a little girl from the dead, and what did he say? "Tell no one." He met a guy with leprosy and healed him, and he said, "Tell no one." He healed two guys who were blind, and he gave them one admonition before moving on: "Say nothing to anyone." In a world driven by self-promotion and spin, Jesus modeled something different for us. Jesus was saying that instead of telling people about what we're doing all the time, there's a better way. One that doesn't require any capes that can get snagged on something. Something like ourselves. Maybe Jesus wants us to be secretly incredible instead. That was his plan for self-promotion. Secretly incredible people keep what they do one of God's best-kept secrets, because the only one who needs to know, the God of the universe, already knows. Being secretly incredible goes against the trend that says to do anything incredible, you have to buy office furniture and a laptop, start an organization, have a mission statement, and labor endlessly over a statement of faith. Secretly incredible people just do things. To be sure, mission statements can have a purpose, and statements of faith too, I suppose, but are they really necessary? I don't think so. Most times, mission statements are just a catchy sentence or two about how noble the task is, and maybe by implication, how noble we are. The truth is, the task would probably be even nobler if we didn't talk about it and just did it instead. It's not about being secretive or mysterious or exclusive. It's about doing capers without the capes. It's usually only religious people who know what a statement of faith is anyway. I guarantee the guy at the deli doesn't. The religious people are the only ones who tease out the missing word or phrase needed to fall in line with their view of faith or doctrine. Their lives aren't really changed by it, of course, and yours isn't either. Getting religious people to agree with detailed mission statements or statements of faith is the same. It's kind of like getting people who already own Chryslers to feel good about owning Chryslers. I'd rather trade all the religious jargon for the chance to invite one person into experiencing Jesus. You want a mission statement to go along with being secretly incredible? Okay, here it is. Be awesome. That's it. If you want to follow Jesus' example about how he did things, that's probably all we'd write down instead of our otherwise heady doctrinal statements. But there's more. I don't think Jesus wants us to make a fashion statement or be edgy or promote ourselves on the back of clothing and bracelets all the time either. I think instead, Jesus wants us to write, Be awesome on an undershirt where it won't be seen, not on the back of a hoodie. Jesus hardly talked to anyone about what he'd done. The Bible never depicts one of those end-of-camp slideshows where Jesus goes over all he'd done with his disciples. Instead, Jesus modeled that we don't need to talk about everything we've done. It's like he was saying, what if we were just to do awesome stuff, incredible stuff together while we're here on earth, and the fact that only he knew about it would be enough? If we did that, we wouldn't get confused about who was really making things happen. Not surprisingly, we'd get a lot more done, too, because we wouldn't care who's looking or taking credit. All that energy would be funneled into awesomeness. Even then, though, don't take the bait that if we do incredible things, Jesus will dig us more. He can't. He already digs us more. And more than that, our pictures are already in his wallet. There are two guys named Judas who were among the 12 who followed Jesus. There was the bad Judas who betrayed Jesus and is the Judas we all know about. Then there's also a good Judas, a guy known as Thaddeus. I had never heard about him. I can imagine the good Judas telling everyone for the rest of his life, just call me Thad. I can also imagine he was probably the first guy to want to go into the witness protection program. After Jesus left, the ones who were following him decided they needed to add another apostle to replace the bad Judas. The requirements were pretty straightforward. The replacement needed to have been with Jesus the whole time he was here, and he had to be a stand-up guy too. There were two guys the apostles came up with. One was a guy named Matthias, and the other guy was nicknamed Justus. I'm not sure how they cast lots back then. Honestly, it sounds a lot like rock, paper, scissors to me. Somehow, however, they picked Matthias. He got the nod and has been in every stained glass window from then on. But I've always wondered, what happened to Justus? We never hear about him again. Yet he did all the right things, saw all the right stuff, knew who Jesus was, and was a faithful guy. The thing is, Justus sounds a lot to me like just us. God's plans are full of just us kind of people. I would say probably the majority of us are just us people, folks who don't get capes or stained glass windows. We just get the opportunity to do what God wants us to do without a lot of fanfare. Even though he lost rock, paper, scissors, I bet Justus was one of those secretly incredible guys who kept on being incredible. We get the same shot. Getting passed by can feel like a great injury, but it's not. It's people like us who can be secretly incredible and get the most done. That's the way Jesus' reverse economy works. God loves the humble ones, and the humble ones often don't make it as the first-round draft picks for the big jobs or big titles or positions. But they always seem to be the first-round picks for God when he's looking for someone to use in a big way. Jesus' message was a simple one. We all get a chance to be awesome if we want to be. Not surprisingly, the way to do it best is by being secretly incredible. We don't know who lowered a friend through the roof to get him in front of Jesus. We never learn the names of the guys who were part of that caper. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if they were people just like us, wearing undershirts that said, "Be awesome." And I'll bet you anything they weren't wearing capes. Chapter 25. God is good. I used to think God was good some of the time, but now I know he's good all the time. I had a friend named Don Valencia, and I miss him. Don Valencia was another one of those secretly incredible guys. He was about my age and full of life when we met. He loved to backpack and race cars and climb mountains, and he'd tell stories about sleeping high above the tree line, or racing his car for a grueling 24 hours nonstop just to see if he could do it. While I'm not a mountain climber and I don't race cars, the more climbing and racing stories Don told me, the more courageous I felt about whatever I was facing. We all have these friends, these amazing people, who seem to live on the edge of death. It must be because it's on the edge where they feel most alive, where they have the best perspective on life. It's where one misstep, one wrong move can end it all, that they realize all over again how beautiful the place they're standing actually is, a place where they live and breathe and love well. Have you noticed that lots of people who trust God seem to be wired to live near the edge? Don's love for adventure translated into his work as a cell biologist. I'm not sure what a cell biologist does exactly, but I know it has something to do with being really smart. Not afraid of death, early on in his career, Don played with some of the world's most devastating diseases by freeze-drying cells so they could be studied. He would literally freeze-dry death and put it under a microscope. It was like Don had a keychain full of keys to doorways opening up to a better existence, and he spent his life sliding the keys into locks to see if they could be opened. I'm sure Don found it ironic that something so ugly as a disease could be redeemed by God and turned into a doorway leading to joy and freedom and a cure. One day, while preparing for a backpacking trip, Don decided to use his freeze-drying technique on coffee. He loved having a cup of coffee on the side of a mountain, but was picky when it came to what he brewed. None of the freeze-dried stuff at the supermarket would do. He tinkered with different beans and different roasts until one day his wife, Heather, stopped by a little startup coffee shop in Seattle and found some beans she thought her husband might be able to use. She brought the beans home, like Jack and his fabled beanstalk. Don freeze-dried them and discovered this new coffee wasn't just good, it was amazing. Don shared his concoction with other backpacking friends, and nobody could believe the coffee had been freeze-dried. I think that after they got in the mountains together at altitude and had a cup together, his friends kept looking around to see where the hidden coffee shop was where Don had scored the fresh brew. That little coffee shop in Seattle, Heather found, exploded into franchises. So Don decided to share his creation with a CEO, a guy named Howard Schultz of Starbucks fame. Howard opened the package Don sent him and tried the freeze-dried coffee with, I'm sure, a pack of skepticism. It wasn't long, though, before he jumped on a plane to visit Don in his kitchen. They talked for hours as Don explained the process he'd gone through to preserve the flavor of the coffee beans. Faster than you can lace up a pair of hiking boots, Howard hired Don. No kidding, Don Valencia was suddenly living in Seattle, heading the research and development arm of Starbucks. No longer doing his work at the kitchen table, Don now had a multi-million dollar laboratory for his experiments. People who take huge risks aren't afraid to fail. In fact, they love to fail. It's because failing means they found the edge. Don created some amazing products for Starbucks, but not all of them worked out. Have you ever heard of MozziGrande, for instance? Exactly, me neither. MozziGrande is a carbonated coffee-flavored soda that Don invented and Starbucks rolled out quite a few years ago. The only problem was, no one liked it. Don didn't seem fazed with disappointment. In fact, one of the first times I visited Don, I walked up his driveway and saw his license plate that proudly read, MozziGrande. The guy celebrated stunning failures like I celebrated my biggest successes. Don taught countless numbers of people how beautiful it is to fail. More so, he demonstrated how beautiful it is to keep trying nevertheless, to keep moving forward and love yourself enough to love your mistakes. It was that same spirit of adventure and dedication to redeem failure that led Don to create the science behind a coffee-flavored, icy concoction called the Frappuccino. That one ended up doing pretty well. Don kept perfecting his freeze-dried coffee, sharing it with friends who were backpackers and the inner circles at Starbucks. Everybody loved the stuff, but for decades, Starbucks wasn't sure if or how they'd release it. I think they were concerned that freeze-dried coffee might hurt the brand Starbucks had established by serving the freshest, highest quality brew. Don's delectable freeze-dried crystals got out to a few people, however, so Starbucks had to give the project covert names, like Stardust and Space Needle and even Jaws. If you work close to Don and were on your way to summit Mount Rainier or have an adventure on the Pacific Crest Trail, you could get your hands on a scarce supply of his concoction. I imagine it must have looked like a drug deal going down as a nickel bag of Stardust changed hands and was slipped into a coworker's backpack next to the ice axe and crampons. Almost two decades later, Don's secret was still under wraps. By that time, Don had retired from Starbucks and had decided to throw himself and his family into different adventures. While always a lover of people, Don had a growing interest in serving them in more tangible ways. He joined the board of a fantastic organization called Agros, which serves the rural poor in Central America, Mexico, and places around the world where the needs are immediate and great. Don moved the family to Central America for a time so they could immerse themselves in both culture and service. Dwarfing his passion for all these things, Don found himself closer to God in the adventure of helping people than he had ever been standing on the edge of a cliff. Not long after returning, while on a trip to Whidbey Island with the Agros Board, Don began to feel a terrible pain in his side. He was whisked to the hospital and diagnosed immediately. He had metastasized stage 4 cancer of the liver and lungs. He was now struggling with the same kinds of diseases he'd studied under a microscope for years. During his brave fight with cancer, Don continued living in a spirit of risk and adventure. It was plain that he was never afraid to die and began to chronicle his journey. I'd read his letters and posts along with many other people, and his spirit of love and hope and anticipation was inexplicable. He said he felt like he was dancing on the edge of heaven, but he wasn't scared. He was almost like a commercial telling everyone how great it was to have cancer. He was that delighted about the opportunity to live even one more day, to take one more breath, to learn one more thing about the character of God. He wanted to move from dancing on the edge of heaven to being in heaven. Don lamented, to be sure, that when he stepped into heaven, he would be leaving his wife and two sons behind for a time. He fought the disease for them and asked God to let him stick around to make as many memories as possible with the people he loved the most. Each time Don wrote a letter or post, he'd end with these words, "God is good, all the time, God is good." It wasn't just something he was telling himself, hoping it was true. It was something he knew for certain, and he was hoping we'd know too as he stood on the edge of heaven. It was like he was peeking through a knothole in the fence at the face of God and telling us what he saw on the other side. When Don spoke, he knew without a doubt God was good. And with every letter, it was as if Don somehow picked the lock again and swung the vault open so we could all look inside at the treasure. Don hiked his last miles valiantly, beautifully knowing that death was just a doorway to something better, something we only see traces of in this life. He saw the love of God in his bride and in the joy he found spending time with his sons. He knew the tunes he heard from his perch on the edge of heaven were just faint songs now, like a favorite song he couldn't quite make out, but he still knew the words, even if his pitch wasn't perfect. You could see in his face that someday he would joyfully join the chorus, maybe as a background vocalist or something. During our friendship, Don had been up to a lodge we built in British Columbia, and in a season of surprising energy, while he fought his cancer, he asked if he and the family could come up and create a family memory. I agreed, of course, and we made plans to receive the man who was teaching so many of us just how good God was. A week before Don and his family were to come, though, his health and energy cratered, and Don found himself back in the hospital doing battle with the effects of his advanced disease. Not wanting his family to miss out on a time to recharge at the lodge, Don asked them to make the trip anyway and leave him behind. He wanted them to have a break as they moved into a season where fewer chapters would be written together. We worked out the details of transportation and communication so we could get the family back to Don in case he needed anything, and the family agreed with Don's wishes to spend a couple of days amid the beauty of the inlet Don had come to love so deeply. It was as though Don was sending the family on an adventure so they could come back and report every detail, what they'd seen and smelled and experienced, and he could live it through them in their stories. Heather and the boys arrived at the lodge, and while Sweet Maria greeted them, I called Don and we spoke on the phone. He was in the hospital bed and we talked about what he was learning about God and how his energy was holding up. Then our conversation turned to the possibility of one last great caper. We laughed about the idea of springing him from the hospital and sneaking him up to the lodge. I felt like I was back in high school plotting to put the principal's car on the roof. And before we realized how absurd it was, we were putting the finishing touches on our caper to get Don to the remote inlet to surprise his family. We hung up the phone, believing God was in the caper, and Don instantly had dozens of friends in on it too in order to pull it off. The only ones who didn't know what was being planned were his family. Don figured out how to get the staff to spring him, tubes and all. He was shuttled to a seaplane waiting for him a few miles away in Lake Union, and it was game on. Don was weak, very weak. The plane ride was long. In fact, it was way too long. The seaplane hit fog halfway to the lodge and was grounded for the night. Don took on all the medical procedures that were typically done by a team of nurses. He did them himself in a small bathroom and he must have felt like he was patching up a wound in the wild, bivouacked on the side of a cliff in a snowstorm. The next morning, I was up early listening to the aviation channels in our radio room at the lodge. Then a crackle came through the static from a friend who was the pilot. The plane was just a few inlets away and closing in fast on his family. I asked about how Don was doing and was told he was almost giddy through the tremendous pain and complete exhaustion of the trip. I realized that Don was right back in his zone, on the edge. I asked Heather and the boys to go down to the dock with my family, explaining that I needed help with a little project and a seaplane would be arriving with some groceries that needed carrying. A short time later, as the seaplane engine stopped and drifted to the end of the dock, I occupied them with a task behind a building so they wouldn't notice the plane's surprise cargo. Don emerged, wearing a red North Face jacket, as though making the final ascent on one of the many peaks he'd scaled in his life. Any mountain would have been dwarfed, however, by the one he had just scaled to get to his family. Heather, glancing up from her task, looked once and then again in disbelief. Don? If there were subtitles coming from her mind, they'd probably read, "How is this possible? You're supposed to be in the hospital fighting for your life." She exploded to her feet and in three gallops fell into Don's strong arms. We made our way up to the lodge, and Don laid down on a large couch in the living room. The boy sat at his feet, and Heather laid by his side. Our family disappeared into the kitchen, but could hear them talking softly, then laughing, then talking softly again. They talked about snowboarding and photography and adventures that lay behind and ahead. Heather and Don held hands and looked into each other's eyes a lot, and without getting up from the couch, they slow danced on the edge of heaven together. Don gave me the gift of a last meaningful conversation, too. I had come to love this man. When the family had left, I laid down on the couch and put my head on his chest. We talked about heaven and eternity and how we'd all be back together at some point. And we talked about how God is good all the time, not just some of the time. Don went to be with Jesus shortly after his last adventure at the lodge. And then Starbucks decided it was time to roll out their best-kept secret. What Don had created 20 years earlier became a reality. Via, as it's known and seen in every Starbucks around the world, is named after Starbucks' first brave inventor, Don Valencia. Who knows how many backpackers have sat down in the great cathedral of the mountains and shared a cup with a man they've never known, but with whom they share the same love of life and risk and beauty. Perhaps those hikers who are looking over the valleys below, watching the fog roll up the rivers from the ocean, are only suspecting something Don Valencia knows to be absolutely true, that God is good all the time. God is good. Chapter 26. Jailbreak. I used to think there were some prisons you couldn't escape, but now I know there's no place I can go where God can't rescue us. Hello, I'd like to speak to Attorney General Ashcroft, please. Who should I say is calling? The secretary at the other end of the line asked. Bob Goff. Bob who? I get that a lot. The secretary told me to call back in 2 hours, which was great, because I was late to a lunch meeting with a friend, Charlie. Charlie had asked me to have coffee with him a week earlier. I'd known Charlie for a number of years. He's another one of those secretly incredible guys who doesn't measure his value by what he has, but what he'd be willing to give up. Charlie is a bright guy, had graduated from law school, and spent his life pursuing justice. But all of his accomplishments were like sawdust on a carpenter's floor compared to his desire to love God and express that in what he does. Charlie said he had something on his mind, and I was looking forward to hearing how I could help as I drove to a nearby Starbucks where we decided we'd meet. Charlie beat me there by a few minutes and had already staked out a table in the sun. "Hi, Charlie. How you doing?" I said as I walked up. After talking about our kids and what we thought the next couple months would look like, Charlie shifted in his seat a little, and I figured I was going to learn why he wanted to get together. "Bob, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've decided that I want to use my legal training to help kids and fight injustice more directly." I nodded in agreement. I could see in Charlie's eyes a focused determination as he talked about how God loved justice and kids and how much he did as well. We talked about the investigations and raids we had been conducting over the past several years in India and Uganda, to help kids get out of brothels and other forms of trafficking. We talked about how I hope to continue to take the fight to the bad guys by enforcing the laws on the books in these various countries we were working in. Charlie was focused and leaning forward as we spoke, the position of his body taking on the position of his forward-leaning heart. We both lost track of time in our conversation as we talked about how much had been done and how much was left to be done. After a few hours, we pushed back from the table and stood up. Charlie shot out his hand to me. "Let's do this thing. I'm in," he said. I laughed to myself because I hadn't proposed anything to Charlie, much less a job. But Charlie didn't make his statement like he was applying for a job. He announced it like he had just created one. Honestly, if anything, I felt like I was applying to work for him. After pausing for a second and grinning, I shot my hand back. "Charlie, it's a deal. Do you want to head up all our investigations for Restore International?" "You bet," he shot back in an instant. And with that, we each started walking towards our respective cars. Halfway there, I looked over my shoulder and shouted to Charlie, "Hey, Charlie, do you want to know what we pay for the position?" "Sure," he shouted back across the hoods of three cars. "Pick a round number," I said. "Zero," Charlie said and belly laughed and kept walking, shaking his head. "Hey, one last question," Charlie shouted to me as he got into his car. "What are the benefits?" "No income taxes," I yelled back to him as I got into my Jeep and started the engine. Charlie quit his job at the FBI and showed up at my office the next day with a couple cardboard boxes full of his things. The larger of the boxes had a plaque on it from his desk. "Agent Walker" is all it said. I can't lie, that registered on my cool meter. Charlie had been with the FBI for years, and he was ready to find a new way to serve God and love kids. Charlie moved in over the laundromat with me, which is where we operate Restore International out of. It's not your typical office, but we decided a long time ago we weren't going to be typical lawyers. Charlie had served under several attorneys general, including John Ashcroft. I told Charlie about my call to his office and my plan. I told him that I thought I'd tear a page from the kids' playbook and ask General Ashcroft to come with me to Uganda. Why not? I'd seen him on CNN a couple times, and I felt like we'd really connected. I'm sure he felt the same way about me. John Ashcroft is a striking man, full to the brim with both integrity and humility. I knew this when he boasted to me later about being the only man he knew of to ever lose an election to a dead guy. As the former governor of Missouri, he'd spent some time as a senator. His re-election bid failed, however, after his opponent, who was the sitting governor, tragically died in a plane crash a few days before the election. Too late to be removed from the ballot, and in an outpouring of love and respect, the dead politician became the first person posthumously elected to the Senate. Far from done, John Ashcroft was tapped by the president shortly afterwards to be the next attorney general for the United States, and in that role, headed the FBI through the September 11th tragedy and several other defining moments in our history. I tried to make contact with General Ashcroft quite a few times. One day, inexplicably, I had the chance to get a message through to him to see if he would come with me to Uganda and make friends with the judges and president. I'm sure he was thinking, "You want me to do what?" Followed by, "Bob who?" We made arrangements to get together and meet a few days later in Washington, D.C. The author of the Patriot Act, General Ashcroft, was probably more amused than anything else to meet me as I began speaking quickly and excitedly to him, waving my arms a lot. "You've just got to come. Everyone will be there. We'll have the president of Uganda there, all the judges, everyone." He asked me to give him all the other details for the trip. I paused, cocked my head, and looked a little confused. I told him I had just given him all the details and started waving my arms around again as I explained my idea again. "We'd just go there and see what happened. That was the plan." In the end, just as inexplicably as we had connected, he said he'd come. A short time later, Agent Walker and I landed in D.C. General Ashcroft got on the plane, and we left for Uganda. I had hired security because of some current tensions, and when we landed in Entebbe, we were met in the airport tarmac by at least a dozen guys with machine guns and sunglasses. They circled us and looked foreboding as they struck chiseled poses and looked outwards with their backs to us. I felt like I was in an action movie, but for the first time, hoped I wouldn't see anything blow up. We left the airport in a motorcade, and when we made our first stop to stretch our legs, I asked one of the guys with a machine gun if I could just squeeze off a couple short bursts in the field. He looked at me with one of those I'm not amused looks. Maybe later. In northern Uganda, because a 20-plus year civil war was still raging between the government on one hand and the Lord's Resistance Army on the other, no high court judge had been to a city like Gulu for more than two decades. What this meant was that justice had been crippled, leaving hundreds of human rights and other cases unheard. I thought we could help, so I purchased the entire Ugandan law library, both books. We started briefing those cases which hadn't been heard and began preparing them for trial. We hadn't been asked to brief cases, of course. We just kind of assumed we could. That's one of the things about love. It always assumes it can find a way to express itself. We asked several brave judges to travel with us to Gulu to start bringing the cases to trial. As inexplicably as John Ashcroft saying he'd come, these judges said they'd come too. Once again, we didn't need to unfold our non-existent game plan on a table. The game plan was simple. We'd just start doing stuff together, and we did, lots of it. After we'd brought over 200 cases to trial in Gulu, the plan that materialized was to bring together all of Uganda's judges, the president, and General Ashcroft to meet, develop friendships, and talk about what had happened and what was possible. Organizations have programs. People have friends. Friends trump programs every time. I welcomed everyone to the meeting, introduced General Ashcroft, and we spent the next couple of days talking about what Uganda's laws were regarding children and the need for a law prohibiting the trafficking of persons in the country. We also talked about the countless number of young people who had been waiting in Ugandan jails for years without ever having stepped into a courtroom. I wondered what it would be like to be a kid and be put in a Ugandan jail cell, so my friends and I started going to the Ugandan jails that housed the kids to find out. It wasn't long before we had visited every Ugandan jail in the entire country. Most of them were old and dilapidated concrete buildings surrounded with razor wire on the wall. It was as if all the buildings were trying to escape, one piece of rust at a time. Inside the typical jail would be 100 or more young Ugandan boys and a dozen girls aged 12 to 17. Dawn and I went to one of the jails. I asked the warden what these kids had been charged with. Mostly it was small crimes, petty thefts and the like. However, some were charged with a more serious crime of defilement, having consensual relations with the other sex before 18. Unfortunately, what can happen is that the parents of a girl in the village who don't approve of a local boy will simply accuse him of defilement. This alone is enough to land him in jail that day. Don and I looked in the registry that listed the names of each of the inmates and the dates they arrived in jail. It turned out that most of these young people had been in jail for 2 or 3 years. I asked how many of the young people had been to court. None, the warden said. None? How come? Don asked. We don't have enough gas money to get them there. You're kidding, right? Don said as he motioned to the courthouse, which could be seen through the warden's office. Let's just walk there right now. It isn't as easy as that, the warden answered. Actually, there are no judges to hear the juvenile cases. I got Don out of the warden's office because Don looked like he was about to start throwing furniture around. I lost track of him in the jail for the next hour. When I found him, he was in a cell block with two young men. The older one, Kevin, was telling him what he'd been accused of. Really heavy stuff, I'd learn later. Don was sitting on the bottom bunk in a dark cell and was holding hands with Kevin, praying for him. Don prayed that Jesus would somehow get Kevin out of the jail and return him to his life. Afterwards, Don told me that he felt kind of bad, thinking perhaps he'd placed some false hopes in Kevin's mind by praying for his freedom. Given the gravity of the charges against Kevin, it seemed a lot more probable that he would spend the rest of his life in jail. Over the next few months, I'd visit with Kevin quite a few times in that jail cell as we prepared his and other cases for trial. Each time I'd arrive, Kevin would ask about a kind man named Don, who held his hands and prayed that he'd be able to return to his life again. Grace works that way. It's a kind word from a gentle person with an impossible prayer. It's a force sometimes transmitted best hand-to-hand in a dark place. We organized with the court for the trials to begin and delivered a stack of legal briefs we'd prepared. We got a judge assigned, and a short time later, 72 cases were set for trial. The children from the jail arrived, their parents arrived, their accusers arrived, the judge arrived, we arrived. It was game day. There was a heaviness in the room as the judge entered. The children glanced back over their shoulders at their parents, ashamed. In a brilliant move, the judge asked the children to leave the courtroom before the trials began and wait in another room as he spoke to the parents assembled. The judge knew that there was a much bigger issue that needed to be dealt with in the room before the trials began. The judge spoke to the parents, and his admonition was simple. Parents, forgive your children. The judge knew that, guilty or not, the children would not be able to move forward in their lives without the forgiveness of their parents. A short time later, he walked into the other room where the children were. Children, your parents have forgiven you. The children were brought back into the courtroom and fell into the arms of their parents. They had received what they needed as much as they needed justice. They had received forgiveness. By the time we had wrapped up the last of the 72 cases brought to trial, we had dropped off 70 of the kids at their homes.